I don't think there's anything more daunting in the Christian life than telling people about Jesus. I actually think it's more scary than running at a prop in rugby. I'm pretty small, they're pretty big, but I actually find it easier than telling people about Jesus. I think I'd even find it easier to wrestle with Ebenezer, have a wee wrestle with him. I think I'd even find that easier than telling people about Jesus. It's just so daunting. And a couple of years ago, a few of us at Latimer, before we'd come to the 7 p.m. service, we'd go over to the botanical gardens and would tell people about Jesus. And it was really daunting. Sometimes we just didn't know what to say. I think I only went twice, and both times that I went, I actually just felt like walking back to church, and I was scared to go again. But we are called to proclaim this good news that we've heard. Jesus commands us to go make disciples of all nations. It's a task given to every follower of Christ. It's a part of what it means to love our neighbour as ourselves. We're to tell people that there's a day of judgment, but there's also a day of forgiveness. It's a daunting task, but we're called to do it. When I was 16, I was looking for a part-time job. I didn't really have any clue at all where I would go to find a job, how I would apply. But one day I was at this restaurant in town with my friend and his parents, and his father knew that I was wanting a job, and he happened to know the owner of this restaurant. So he just told me, before we'd even ordered the meal, he said, "All right, I know you're looking for a job. Just go up to the owner and ask him for a job." And I just freaked out. I was absolutely terrified. I was like, what am I going to say? I was only 16 at the time. I hadn't met the guy. I probably looked about 12. What am I going to say to this guy? So I said, I said back to my friend's father, I said, what am I going to say? How am I going to convince this guy? And he just said, "Just be yourself. Just try crack a few jokes and see what happens." After a lot of thought and some serious peer pressure, I went over to the owner, and within about 2 minutes, which seemed about half an hour, but 2 minutes of speaking to him, he gave me the job. It actually had turned out that my friend's father had already talked to this guy. He knew him really well. He'd already talked to this guy about me, and he said as long as I went up to him and talked to him, he was always going to give me the job. And it was fine. Well, I think that's a little bit like Moses in chapter 3 and 4. God has given him a task. He is to lead the Israelite nation out of slavery. And Moses is all worried about how he could possibly do it and what he would possibly say. But God has got it all sorted behind the scenes. Now, it may feel like, what's a book written about some dude 3,500 years ago got to do with us here today? But like Moses, God has given us, his people, a mission. Moses' mission was to call the Israelite people out of slavery. Our mission is to call people from every nation to the Lord Jesus. And like Moses makes objections and finds this a daunting task, so do we. So we can learn from Moses tonight. Moses' objections to his mission actually start back in chapter 3, which we looked at last week if you were here. The start of chapter 3 is the first time that Moses meets with God, and this is in the form of a burning bush. God told Moses, who was likely 80 years old, probably couldn't really walk properly, and he was told that he was going to be the one to lead the people out of Israel, lead the Israelite people out of slavery and up out of Egypt. This is where Moses starts his series of excuses, which at the time they actually do seem pretty fair. There are two excuses Moses makes in chapter 3. First, Moses says to God, "Who am I? What's so special about me that I should be the one to do this task?" Then in his second excuse, he asks God, "If I go to my people, the Israelites, How will they know who sent me? What should I tell them? And in chapter 3, God answers each of Moses' objections. So he tells Moses that he will be with him. He's not alone. There's nothing special about you, Moses, but I will be with you. And then God says, it is he who is sending Moses to save his people. The great I am, God himself, the creator of the universe. The one who says he is sending Moses. Now at this point, you might think that Moses is ready to go. He's ready to take on this task that God has given him. But no, he's not done yet. And we're going to see two more objections in chapter 4, which we'll look at tonight. So we'll think about these for a few minutes. So God says, go tell my people that I have come to save them. And Moses' first objection comes in chapter 4, verse 1. What if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? No one is going to believe me. What could I say to make these people believe me? What could I possibly say? Isn't that what we all think as well? Like, who is going to believe me if I tell people that Jesus is the Lord of the universe? Why would people listen to me? Who is going to believe me if I tell people that Jesus died on the cross for them? Who is going to believe me if I told them that Jesus not only died on the cross, but then he rose again from the grave? No one's going to believe me. So why should I tell them? You see, we think the way that Moses thinks. It's not like Moses is even on good terms with the Israelites at this point. Back in chapter 2, he was caught out for killing an Egyptian, and then he's called out by all his fellow Hebrews. I don't think that these Israelites were thinking of Moses as a hero, as we often do. What if they don't believe me? Moses says. They all hate me. I'm coming up 80, and this task is too weighty. There's just no way they will listen to me. So God shows him three signs, which we'll look at briefly. God answers his objection in verse 2. Have a look down. Then the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? A staff, he replied. The Lord said, throw it on the ground. Moses threw it on the ground, and it became a snake, and he ran from it. I don't think Moses' mood would have changed much after seeing this staff turn into a snake. He's pretty old, and that staff's probably holding him up, and God turns it into a snake. Then have a look down at verse 4. Then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake, and it turned back into a staff in his hand. So Moses, he starts by running away from the snake. He's probably actually only walking because he's not that fast and he's quite old. But he's running away from the snake. And then God tells him to touch its tail. I don't think he's just going to grab it straight away. He's already scared of the snake. He's probably shivering. He's probably like, okay, I'm going to do it. But even the fact that he does take it, that actually is pretty crazy. That takes courage to do that. I've never done it before. So we've got to be quite impressed with Moses' faith in doing this. He probably trusts that God, you know, he trusts that it's not poisonous. He knows it's not poisonous. But I still wouldn't call him a hero yet. But what God is doing here is changing something very ordinary and turning it into something miraculous. There was nothing special about this staff. It was probably very old. It had probably been knocked around a bit. I'm sure all the other shepherds in the area, they use this similar sort of staff. We wake up and we take our keys and wallet to work. Moses, he just takes his staff. There's nothing special about it at all. So there was nothing special about this staff. That's what we think. And there was nothing special really about the snake, but that's not what the Egyptians think. Because in the Egyptian culture, a snake is this highly honored and it's almost seen as like this divine goddess to them. So Moses being able to change his staff into a snake would actually be a big deal for these Egyptians. Because of God's power, this ordinary stick would end up changing lives, as we're going to see in the coming weeks. But obviously Moses needed more convincing, so God shows him another sign in verse 6. Verse 6, then the Lord said, put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, it was leprous like snow. Moses was probably quite glad that his hand didn't turn into a snake this time, but the outcome, it wasn't much better. Leprosy at this time was, in this culture, was very common in Egypt. Common, but it was very feared. You get it, and you'll be quarantined till you die. There was no vaccine for this disease, so if you get it, you'll be thinking, my life is over. And Moses, again, must have been so fearful. His hand went from fully healthy and usable to fully leprous and unusable. This time he can't run away from it like he did with the snake. I think it's pretty hard to run away from your own hand. I've never been able to do that. So I'm sure Moses was, he was still very scared. But God says, put your hand back inside your cloak. And so Moses does so. And once again, it's restored like the rest of his flesh. So it must have been thought of, if they don't believe after seeing the staff turn into a snake, then show them your hand being turned into leprous and restored again, and then maybe they'll believe. But there's a third sign, and this sign can only take place while Moses is in Egypt. So take a look. This is verse 9. But if they do not believe these first two signs or listen to you, take some water from the Nile and pour it on dry ground. The water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. At this time, the Nile was the lifeblood for those living in Egypt. You take away the Nile, they die. It was one of the most densely populated places in all of ancient times because everyone had to live so close to the river. They hadn't figured out yet how to live away from the source. And so everyone, they just strung along the Nile. In their minds, the Nile was everything. And so God being able to turn this water of the Nile into blood, which we'll see in a few weeks in chapter 7, will cause chaos for those living in the land. So God has showed Moses these three signs. He showed him his power to change anything that just seems totally normal and then turn it into something miraculous. But why? Why is he trying to show, what is he really trying to show Moses? Well, verse 5 answers it. Moses asks in verse 1, what if they do not believe me? So God says in verse 5, this, said the Lord, is so that the people may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. God doesn't just leave Moses to prove to the people that God has sent him. God will prove it by showing his power through these signs. God will do it. And what God gives to Moses, God has given to us in the person of Jesus. The message we proclaim is the message of Jesus. And Jesus came with signs of his power so that we might believe the message is true. We know that Jesus is who he claimed to be because of the signs, the miracles he performed. But in the New Testament, we get this same objection when people hear about Jesus. They hear that he's from God. They hear that he's the chosen king and that he will rescue his people. Prove it, they say. Anyone can say I'm the Son of God, but prove it. So he does. He makes the lame walk. He makes the blind see. He makes the mute able to speak. Jesus is the sign that people may believe he really is the Son of God. His own resurrection is the ultimate proof that he is who he says he is. This is far bigger than a staff becoming a snake. This is a dead man being raised from the grave. Jesus proves this again to Thomas in John chapter 20, verse 28, after he'd risen from the dead. Jesus says to him, put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. stop doubting and believe. Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Jesus came in power to show that he really was from God, that we might believe him. If you're listening today and you've never taken the claims of Jesus seriously, please do. They're not just pie-in-the-sky ideas. They're things that God has done and proven he has done in the history of the person of Jesus. Moses didn't have anything to worry about because it was God's power that was working through him. He didn't need any of his own power. He just needed to show the power of God in order for the people to believe. And we are the same. The message we proclaim comes with power. God has given us all the evidence we need in order for people to believe. We must just point them to the evidence. Moses didn't have any power of his own, but now God has proven his own power. So Moses, he's all ready to go. He's got all he needs now. But as we carry on in this passage, this doesn't seem to be the case. Moses is not done yet, and he's not going anywhere. God had just showed him three amazing signs, and you'd think Moses would say, "All right, Lord, I've run out of ideas now. I've run out of excuses. You've proven how powerful you are. I'll do as you say, and I'll show my fellow Israelites that God really has sent me to deliver you out of slavery and up out of Egypt." But Moses still has another objection to God sending him to deliver the people. Have a look in verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, "O Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and of tongue." His first objection was that no one would believe me. And now it's, "I'm not good at speaking. Lord, I can't speak on your behalf. I can't speak to this level. It's too far above me. The people will probably just laugh at me. How am I going to speak to them? I'm not good at speaking." So God answers in verse 11. The Lord said to him, "Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and teach you what to say." Moses thinks it's all up to him. He thinks it's up to how well he can speak. He thinks it's about having all the right words to say. God made mouths to speak. He's the one who opens and shuts mouths. He's the one who makes people able to see or not. He controls the speaker and the hearer. "I will help you speak and teach you what to say," God tells him at the end of verse 12. God's saying to him, "Don't worry about your lack of ability to speak. Don't worry about not having the right words, right things to say. It's not up to you. It's up to me. I have the words to say, and I will help you say them." I'm pretty confident that every Christian here feels exactly like Moses at times. We have these similar thoughts in our minds before we go to talk to someone about Jesus. What am I going to say to them? How am I going to say something that just sounds really convincing? Maybe I need to practice in my head a few times what I'm going to say so I don't stumble or mumble my words. Or maybe I actually don't need to say anything because someone else will tell them. So, yeah, I'm going to go with that option and just hope that someone else will tell them and that they'll get saved some other way. But once again, what God gives Moses, he gives to us in the person of Jesus. In Jesus, we're given the message to proclaim to people. We don't have to make up some new appealing message. We don't need to be creative. We don't need to come up with new clever arguments. We just have to proclaim Jesus Christ and him crucified. And we see this in the Apostle Paul. So just stay in Exodus, but have a look up on the screen behind me and I'll read the verses out for us in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 1 to 5. "When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness and fear and with much trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power. How did Paul, the one so many Christians look up to, how did he teach people about Jesus? Well, it says in verse 1, he did not come with eloquence and superior wisdom. He didn't use wise or persuasive words like it says in verse 4. My message and my preaching were not with wise or persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest on men's wisdom. How did he do it? He simply preached Christ and him crucified, as it says in verse 2. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. He preached the gospel. This is the gospel in short. G, God. O, offers. S, sinful. P, people. E, eternal. L, life. God offers sinful people eternal life, and that's through sending Jesus to die on the cross. It is the good news that God will one day restore this world to what it should be, that he will get rid of sin and death and pain. The good news that Jesus died on the cross in our place, that he took the punishment that we deserve so that we might be forgiven. This is the message that we've been called to proclaim. We don't have to worry about what to say, because this is God's words. He has given them to us, and they are words with power, the power for salvation. It is not us who saves people, it is God, and he does it through his message. Almost every time I have a conversation with a non-Christian that doesn't seem to go well, I get really annoyed at myself. Wow, why didn't I just say that better? How do they not understand that? I'm sure I said the right things. But the worst and the most shameful part is when I think to myself, there is no way God could change them. They're just too far gone. Shame on me for thinking that. It doesn't depend on me, but upon God. We proclaim a powerful message which has been given to us by a powerful God. If we go back to Moses for a second, he's got all he needs to go and do the task that God has given him. But then he says in verse 13 of chapter 4, "Oh Lord, please send someone else to do it." And God's anger burned against Moses, we are told. We must go and make disciples of all nations, calling people to put their trust in Jesus. And we must go willingly, not reluctantly, like Moses did. We can't make up these same excuses that Moses does. We can't just ask others to do the task that we have been told to do. We have been told to do it, and we should want to do it. It's a privilege to be used by God to call people to himself. And we do it, not on our own, but in the power of God and his word. If we say we love God and love our neighbor, then the most loving thing we can do is tell others about Jesus. The last verses of our passage today talk about Aaron helping Moses speak to the Israelites. And we can help each other too. God gives us people in our lives to help us, to encourage, to speak about Jesus. But we need to do it. We need to do it. It's hard. It can be daunting, but we need to do it. Before I finish, just remember this. When we proclaim this good news, God's power works through me, and his word is with me. We have everything we need to go out and make disciples of all nations. God's power works through me, and his word is in me. Let's pray.